The superintendent's crime. The sun was setting in the summer sky of August 17, 1661, when the young king of France descended from his gilded carriage onto the front steps of the Chateau Vaux-le-Comte. Only a few years in the making, and still under construction, the chateau was the pride and glory of its owner, Nicolas Fouquet, the king's superintendent of finances. At Vaux, he had built his dream house and garden, a magical land of canals and fountains, woods and fruit groves, open vistas and hidden springs, sparing no expense in his presentation for the royal visit. Fouquet was determined to dazzle his guest with a celebration worthy of a king. The noble first led the king and his retinue on a tour of the elegant new chateau, designed by his favorite architect. He guided them through the main hallway decorated by France's leading painter, then showed them onto the gardens beyond it created by the inimitable André Le Nôtre. There they walked through the broad central avenue that stretched southward from the center of the chateau to the garden's farthest end, dividing it into two near-identical halves. They passed between rectangular gardens, known as the embroidery, for their exquisitely gardened patterns, and gazed into the placid water circle between the two straight branches of the central canal leading east and west. Proceeding between the symmetrical pools of Triton, they paused to meditate before the great square mirror of water, and finally settled down in front of a semicircular grotto. There they were treated to a performance of The Boars, a new comedy ballet Molière had written for the occasion. A sumptuous meal served to each member of the royal court and the 5,000 household guards was followed by a display of fireworks. They shot up from the chateau's central dome and lit up the sky, then slowly descended on the gardens like midnight suns. The next morning, Fouquet saw the king off, still basking in the glow of royal approval. But as the king settled himself in the royal carriage on his way to the royal castle of Fontainebleau, he turned to his aging mother and remarked with disdain, "Ah, madame, should we not make these people disgorge all of that?" Louis XIV was only 23 years old at the time, but already a man of his word. 3 weeks after the festivities at Vaux, he invited Fouquet to join him on a royal trip, and there he set his trap. While showing every sign of favor to an audience with the superintendent, he secretly summoned the Comte d'Artagnan, captain of the king's musketeers, to the adjacent room. The Comte, the historical inspiration for Alexandre Dumas' famous hero, had known Fouquet for years and had benefited from his largesse, but he did not hesitate. At a sign from the king, the dashing musketeer sprang forward and placed his former friend under arrest. Soon after, Fouquet was put on trial for despoiling the royal treasury. His personal popularity and friends in high places helped sway the judges sufficiently to spare his life and sentence him to permanent exile. But the king would not be denied. By a royal decree, he commuted Fouquet's sentence from exile to life imprisonment and kept him locked up in an Alpine fortress for the remainder of his days. He died a forgotten man in 1680 without ever setting eyes on his beloved estate again. That's from the opening of Proof by Amir Alexander, How the World Became Geometrical. Proof offers us a new way of looking at geometry, a way of understanding the world that few of us focus on. And thus today's book, Geometry Can Be, as Galileo wrote hundreds of years ago, and a bit before that exciting episode that took place in France. Geometry, our author tells us, in the centuries since it was brought down to earth, has been adopted, utilized, and exploited by almost every conceivable art, profession, and political dogma. It was enlisted in support of French absolutism, as we just heard, American republicanism, and British imperialism, to name but a few. It has served science, but also philosophy, as treatises as diverse as Descartes' Principles of Philosophy, Hobbes's Leviathan, and Spinoza's Ethics model themselves on Euclid's Elements. To these, one could add the ancient art of painting and the new one of ballet, the crafts of architecture and gardening, and more. There was, in fact, no limit to geometry's reach. As the perpetual secretary of the Paris Academy of Sciences put it in 1699, quote, "Any work on ethics, politics, criticism, and perhaps even rhetoric will be better if done by a geometer." As a discipline, as a way of looking at and understanding the world, geometry promises us that the world can be ordered, measured, appealing to our desire for stability and for understanding. Yes, proof is not a mathematical treatise. Instead, it spends much of its pages, many of its pages, discussing the political, the architectural, and therefore social underpinnings of our world by and through geometry. Our story is told through characters from history, men mostly, European men mostly, whose minds and careers were enriched or even determined by their work with geometry. And so it is that we begin our story in ancient Greece with Euclid, with Pythagoras, with some of those other great Greek thinkers who live with us still, moving quickly on to the story of Renaissance Italy of several hundred years ago in the newly awakening city-states, where the rebirth of intercity and Mediterranean-based sea trade creates a new wealth not seen for centuries, a wealth that seeks to express itself through merchants' patronage of the physical arts, leading to the awakening as well of the artist for hire. We follow the story of several such artists, focusing on two in particular who find their fame and not a little fortune in the newly thriving city-state of Florence, and by way of the Renaissance's fascination with the ancient cultures of Italy and Greece, with visits by our aspiring architects to the still decrepit town of Rome. The once imperial capital of the Western world had devolved into a town-sized expanse largely composed of hovels and many poor urchins. But even then, still a showplace of ancient architectural splendor, splendor that was to incite the imaginations of more than one soon-to-be-famous artist. We take up our story again with the 17th century of France, of Louis XIV, as we see the modern world beginning to take shape now through royal patronage, with magnificent estates and gardens for the royal court laid out with geometric precision and under geometric guidance. These are years of great splendor and magnificence, yes, years when the jealousy of the young king could and did result in that great noble's internment into an austere mountain fortress because of the king's suspicious jealousy, a king's jealousy that whisked away a great nobleman's freedom and whisked away as well, literally, the noble's estate and architect and gardener, all now to serve a new master, King Louis himself. Our story of geometry does not end with France, crossing the deep Atlantic Ocean to find a new home and new minds to inspire in the nascent American Republic. We read the true life tales of the creation story of a new capital city of Washington, District of Columbia, a city meant to hearken back to the ancient European archetypes of mathematically ordered architecture, streets, and neighborhood design, bridging one ancient ideal into the new geometric-minded late 18th century, with eyes wide open to the open-ended, ordered, and hopeful young nation whose capital the city is to be. Washington, D.C. was, is still, in many ways, a city conceived from a city planner's oh-so-very humanly conceived, geometrically precise, intellectually ordered layout. Originally built, not without some irony, one might go so far as to say humanly imposed on the chaos of a former swamp, the edge of a great river flowing into the Atlantic. And yes, for all of its geometric beauty and wonder, Washington, D.C., too, is a city built with the labor of enslaved Americans, even as it was dreamt of as a geometric wonder of the then modern world. Conceived as a national capital, and at the same time, a living symbol of the original sin of the American experience, a complexity that we continue to grapple with to this day. And once again, as always with proof, we read these intellectual leaps of wonder and order through the stories of the architects, L'Enfant in particular, the gardeners, the patrons, George Washington, whose fascination with and belief that a geometrically infused mind led to lives of order and success brought this new capital city into being. In sum, Proof tells the story of at once abstract and yet very practical disciplines, those of geometry, through geometry's very human stories. As this book is focused on Italy, France, the young United States, it leads one to ask if all this makes Proof a bit too masculine and Western-centric. Yes, yes it does. Or at least it can for some. But for this reader, Proof led me on to wonder about how geometry, all those circles and angles and lines and cosines that so many of us studied assiduously in our school careers, has come to and will continue to influence, nudge, result in the development of the rest of the world, how we see it, how we make it. If you're looking for proofs of geometric or mathematical questions in the traditional sense of the term, you won't find many of them here. You will actually find a few. But if you're looking for why geometry is a key to examining the world as we came, come, and are coming to know it, you'll be a happy reader. Let's finish with words from our author's own pen, as he tells us. We have, without a doubt, come a long way from the geometrical determinism of Versailles, where Euclidean principles enforced immutable social hierarchy and royal supremacy. And yet the legacy of Louis XIV's kingdom within a kingdom is still with us. This is the case not only in our gardens, our city streets, but also in our governments, state bureaucracies, civil service. The orderly hierarchy of local, regional, and national government, for example, recapitulates the natural hierarchy of power on display at Versailles. The smooth flow of directives from decision makers at the top tiers of state bureaucracies to enforcers at the bottom. A real-life manifestation of Versailles' ideal of unhindered power descending from the palace on the hill to every corner of the gardens. We are almost as far removed from the Enlightenment optimism of L'Enfant's federal city, where ubiquitous geometrical patterns guaranteed timeless republican principles. And yet the careful balance between the different branches and levels of government, so elegantly written into the city's streets and plazas, remains the core of the American governmental system. More broadly, the universal ideals Americans hold dear, such as equality and inalienable human rights, also have their roots in L'Enfant's geometrical vision of a harmonious world governed by ubiquitous and eternal principles. And so, although the grand claims of the geometrical age appear hopelessly out of touch with our modern multicultural world, and though their belief that the truth in one, rational, and eternal teeters under a constant barrage of criticism, it seems we simply cannot do without these principles. If relativists from left and right attack the old mainstream center, it is those claims to universal values and timeless rationality they are attacking. But in the end, even the fiercest critics of universal reason cannot do without the claims encoded in the Euclidean geometries of Le Notre and L'Enfant. Agree? Disagree? It's up to you. But it's an interesting read, and one I think that you, as well, will enjoy. Proof! How the World Became Geometrical by Amir Alexander. It's available at all of our fine local libraries, including, of course, the West Lafayette Public Library.